So we begin here on the top of Pechad and Aleph by the two dots. The Mishnah described that if the signature is not below the get, but rather on the side of the get or on top of the get, that is problematic, and the get is not kasher. Gemara now has a problem because Ini va'rav chotim min atzad. Didn't Rav used to sign the documents on the side? So now we have Rav signing documents on the side, indicating that signing on the side is fine, versus our Mishnah, which says that if you sign on the side of the document, it's not a good document. So Gemara is going to have to draw a distinction between what practice of Rav and that which was mentioned in our Mishnah. Gemara says, "Hotam b'shigago klapei ktav." That's when the roof of the signature is towards the writing. So the difference being which way the signature faces. That's Rashi points out over here. "Deha vaday al get zechatam." Rashi says, then for sure that was signed on this get. Umatznitin, and our Mishnah ishikuragle achatima klapei ktav get. When the foot or the feet of the signature are towards the get itself. Here Rashi, and we noted this yesterday, says that the problem with having the signature on the side or the top is that we fear that that signature belonged to another get. So there was a get that came from the side in towards this get, and then there was a signature at the bottom of that get. Then they severed or cut off the get, and then the signature is left, and it looks like it's written up or together with the get that is in the middle on its side. So that's what we're afraid of. Or on top, the same thing. We're afraid there was a get above there, then there was a signature. So that's only true when the raglayim, the base of the signature, faces towards the current get, because that opens up the possibility that there was another get above the signature, and this was the bottom of a get. So that's where the problem lies. But if the signature is the other way around, where the roof of the signature is towards the get that exists, then obviously it wasn't at the base of another get, because this get right now is in the space where it could have been at the base of the get. So therefore, in the end, the problem case in our Mishnah is where the foot of the signature, the base of the signature, faces towards the get that we have now, because then there could have been a get above that, whether it was coming from the side or coming from the top, and therefore we don't want that. That's what Rashi says. But if this top of the signature, the gag, the roof of the signature, faces towards the get, the writing of the get, then we don't worry about it, because the only thing it could have been was a get below that signature, and a get on the top is no good. So that's how we differentiate. That's the way Rashi explains it. And that explains, according to Rashi, what the psul is when we have these signatures around the side and the top, is our fear that it's really part of another get. And then he usurped it to use for his get by slicing off the get that was associated with that signature. Others just suggest that the possibility that the signature was there prior to the fact that this get was written. And so we want to make sure that the signature is associated with this get and not something that was just there before. So there, it's a little harder to make the distinction that Rashi makes over here, because then how do you know? Why does it matter whether the feet of the signature or the head, top of the signature facing the get? And therefore you might have to read Gago Klapei Aktav somewhat differently in this case to show that it wasn't that the signature was there prior and he wrote the get. The Gago Klapei Aktav would be read in the opposite way, which is that when the roof of the Ktav is towards the get, then he probably didn't write the get afterwards. When the Raglayim, feet, are towards the Ktav, then it's possible that he wrote it afterwards. So for instance, you have a signature on top, and then he drops the get from that signature down. So that's when the feet are facing the get, that's where you could have that problem. On the other hand, if the get is opposite the way that the signature is, then it was unlikely that he's going to get it exactly to fit and be in there where the signature is going one way and the get goes the other way. So you could explain it the other way based on that, but depends on what you think the reason for the psul is over here. Elahadiktani, ekif rosho shel zeh, betzad rosho shel zeh. What about in the Mishnah where you have two gitin that start in the middle and extend to the two sides? Vayedim be'emtza, and then you have edim between the two gitim, shnehem psulim. Our Mishnah says they're both psulim. That's problematic, because for at least one of those two gitin, you have the ktav, that top of the signature against the top of the get. For the other one, it's in the same direction. So one of them, you agree, would be pasul. One of them should be kasher. But let's say, ha'minayu klapei ktav, v'lit kasher. Let's see which one, according to Rashi, is going opposite the ktav. and that one would be kasher. Whichever one the signature is head to head with that get, meaning that the top of the signature and the top of the get are touching, in that case, that would be a kosher get, because it couldn't have been the bottom of another get, because it's upside down for the bottom of another get. So at least that get should be kasher over here. It says, hotam deramile ke'ivro. Over there, he made it like an ivra. An ivra is the cross beam that they used to use to lock the doors. In their day, they didn't have strong locks on the door. They had a bar that used to be placed across the door where you close the door and then you put in a beam or some crossbar that touches the two doorposts and the door and barricades the door from opening. That's their lock. So ki'ivra, ivra is that crossbar. That crossbar runs perpendicular to the mezuzot. So you have the two doorposts, and that beam, if you put it in there, runs perpendicular to them. So that's the same thing over here, that the signature is running perpendicular to the two gitin. Just that you have two gitin that are starting in the middle and going out in each direction. And then the signature, instead of being in line with the writing of either of the gitin, it's perpendicular to the two gitin. So you have the writing going out, and then in the middle you have a signature, but the signature is not parallel to either of the two gitin. It's perpendicular. It joins the two gitin by being perpendicular, basically bridging between the two gitin. Where it says, Yachi. That's the case. That's why I explain it. Sefer Diktani Rosh Hashanah Betzad Sofer Shel Zeh. In the case where you have one get written, and then underneath it you have another get written in the same direction. And then there's a signature in between them. In that instance, we said, whichever get has the edim at the end of it, that get is kasher. For the get that the edim are above it, that get is pasul. But if the signature here is perpendicular, you don't read the signature with either of the two kitin, because now it's perpendicular. Ella, so the Gemara, when it says Ella, it's rejecting that explanation completely. Rav bediske havichotim. Diske, which are not documents of raya, but rather subpoenas that were written in order to bring the bali dinim to the court. So they sent out the subpoena, the diske. Rav, whenever he got it, he just signed wherever it was on there. He didn't necessarily sign at the bottom. He just signed wherever it was on the diske to give it the tokef, the power that it needed to go out and use it and have Rav's signature on it. But he wouldn't sign necessarily at the bottom, on the top, or the side. But since it's not a shtar, in the classic sense of a shtar, which you're going to use for collection or a get, there he wasn't so careful about where he signed on the document. So Rav did sign on the side or on the top, which otherwise would be pasul in other instances. Nevertheless, over here he signed there because he was just running through them quickly. They gave him a whole bunch of subpoenas to sign, and he would sign them quickly just wherever it was on the document. But that's not to give evidence or in contradiction to our Mishnah, because he wasn't signing them in a sense of an official capacity as a shtar. It wasn't functioning in that way. Get, shekitavo ivrit. And then we ended off, the Mishnah said, ketav sofer ve'ed kasher. You have the handwriting of the sofer, and an aid, it's kasher. Amar Rabbi Yirmiya, chatam sofer shaninu. The ketav sofer over here does not mean the handwriting of the sofer, but rather his signature. The understanding of this Mishnah is that you have a signature of the sofer and the signature of another eid. In other words, you have two eidim, and one of those is the sofer himself. Amar Rav Chista Hamani. So Rav Chista says, who's the author of this position here? Rabbi Yossi. It must be Rabbi Yossi. This goes back, we saw this back on Samach Vav Amud Bet. We saw this on Ayin Aleph Amud Bet, that Rabbi Yossi is of the belief that you can't send a shliach for intangible items, or you can't give instructions to a shliach. Shliach can carry out actions. Mile, lo mimsere le shliach. Words cannot be conveyed to a shliach. And for that reason, this is why over here we say that chatam sofer shaninu. That the chatam sofer. The Gemara back there explains, because if it's not the case, yatsa mimenu churva. You could have a terrible situation arise from this, which is, so over there, the Gemara says back on Samach Vavam Bet, so there were two levels of mile lo mimsere le shliach, if you remember there. And one of them was that you can't give these intangible instructions to a edim. The second one is that you can't say, it says, Mode Rabbi Yossi be omer amru, imru. that Rabbi Yossi agrees in a case where he tells them to tell someone else to do something, that's fine. So the Gemara says that if Rabbi Yossi agrees to that, nafik imenu churva, that would lead to a terrible outcome. The zimnin, the amrul lishnayim, because sometimes they'll instruct two people, imrul is sofer v'yichtov, tell the sofer to write the get, oloploni oploni v'yichtemo, and then tell so-and-so to sign on it. Omishum kisufa de sofer, because they're worried about the embarrassment of the sofer, chayshi umechabtme, they're going to worry about that, they're going to have one of the edim sign on it, v'sade v'sofer badayu, and have the sofer sign on it, so that he's not embarrassed by the fact that the Baal asked him to write it, but didn't ask him to sign it. And therefore, you're going to have the failure of carrying out the instructions of the Baal. But so, if it's according to Rabbi Yossi, who says you can never instruct parties to do such a thing, you can't instruct them to instruct someone else. So here, they can't instruct the sofer to write, or instruct other edim to sign on it. Therefore, you will never have this problem arise, where they're telling the sofer to write it, and out of embarrassment, they'll let him sign it, even though that was not the instruction. And that's what's being said over here. The reason that the Chatam Sofer, the signature of the Sofer, is good in this instance, is because it's Rabbi Yossi. And according to Rabbi Yossi, since you cannot send instructions through Shlichim, you can't instruct them to instruct others, we'll never have that scenario where they'll be embarrassed about the Sofer, and they'll tell him to sign on it instead of the other parties. Because everybody has to get the instructions directly from the Baal. And if you don't get the instructions directly from the Baal, then you're not allowed either to sign it or not allowed to write the get. So in that instance, if the sofer is signed there, that's because he got the direct instructions from the Baal, not because it came through hearsay, through other shlichim telling him that that's what the Baal wants, and they felt bad for him and let him sign when he wasn't supposed to sign it. So that's what it means. Amani Rabbi Yosihi. Now, the Gemara over there suggested that even if Rabbi Yossi holds that you can do that, it may not be a problem because lo shchiach. It's not a common case. Because we pass in the locha, this type of behavior or this type of instruction, we said is kasher, v'lo tasekein b'Yisrael. The get is kasher, but we tell you don't do such a thing. Since the Chachamim dissuaded people from acting in this manner, it was lo shchiach. And if it's lo shchiach, we don't worry about this churva aspect, which is that it was an uncommon case. Since it's an uncommon case, you don't worry about it. But here, Rav Chista believes that Rabbi Yossi obviously does not like to convey information in such a manner. And so because of that, you won't have this churva. And that's why the signature of the sofer works in this instance. Hai ktubat chatanim, ta'achi lekameh de Rabbi Yabau. There was this tuba of a chatan that came before Rabbi Yabau. They recognize the writing or the handwriting of the core text as well as one of the signatures. So they recognize who the sofer is because of the writing, and they also recognize one of the edim. Savar Lakshura. He wanted to make it kasher because he has Ktav Sofer and he has one of the edim. And that's our Mishnah. Ktav Sofer Veid Echad should be sufficient. Here reading Tav Sofer to mean the handwriting of the Sofer. Amalei Rabbi Yirmiyah, Chatam Sofer Shaninu. When the Mishnah writes Tav Sofer, it doesn't mean the handwriting of the Sofer, but rather the signature of the Sofer. In other words, Rabbi Yirmiyah says we paskin, not just by Gitin, but by all Shtarot, that Chatam Sofer Shaini. And now, based on this, Tosfot says, Mashma da halocha ke Rabbi Yirmiyah. Based on this conclusion of the Gemara, it sounds like the locha is like Rabbi Yirmiyah. Because over here, Rabbi Yirmiyah is instructing Rabbi Abahu to act on this position of Rabbi Yirmiyah and only be makshirit when you have Chatam Sofer and not when you have the Ktav Sofer. So then the conclusion from Rabbi Yirmiyah is that if the Sofer is signed and you have one aid on the get, then it would be a fine get. Nevertheless, Tosfot says, after saying that the mashma the locha is like Rabbi Yirmiyah, it says, Mikom Makom, in lachshir Chatam Sofer be'eid v'gitim, Mikoach Rabbi Yirmiyah. Taha l'chol amurai b'sof perkei tkabel, back on Samach Vav and Bev, which we just read, the makshrei b'omer amru, yesh l'vsol chatam sofer. Because they believe that Rabbi Yossi does say that you can pass instructions to another party. Then you should be posel chatam sofer v'eid. You should have the nafik mei churva. Because you could have a terrible outcome come from that. So only if you believe that Rabbi Yossi does not allow for instructions to be given to shlichim to instruct other parties, does Rabbi Yirmiyah's statement true, which is that the Chatam Sofer and the Eid are good. But if you believe that Rabbi Yossi thinks you can, and that was the machloket there in the Gemara, as to whether how far Rabbi Yossi's statement goes about not passing intangible items or mile, you can't pass words through a shliach, over there, there is mostly a Moraim belief that you can pass instructions to a shliach if you're instructing him to instruct others, but Omer Imru, that works. If that works, then if you do have a problem with the churva, which is the possibility that when the sofer signed on here, he wasn't signing because he was supposed to sign on it, but because the shlichim felt bad for him and let him sign on it, and then the get is really a pasul get. So Tosafot concludes that even though we might paskin like Rabbi Yirmiyah, if we don't paskin like Rav Chista suggests within Rabbi Yossi over here, you have a problem, because then there could be yetzach churva mimeno. Even though the Gemara over there on Samach Vav Amud said, it's mile de lo shchiach, something that's not common, and therefore maybe we shouldn't worry about it. The Gemara later on, in Ayin Aleph Amud Be'et, leaves out that whole piece about mile de lo shchiach. There we discuss the fact that it seems like the Gemara just says, etc. You know the Gemara back from Samach Vav. But over here, Tosafot seems to indicate that that answer of mile de lo shchiach is not strong enough, and therefore we would not allow Chatam Sofer Ve'eid because of our chashash by Rabbi Yossi, and that yetzah mimenu churva, and because of that, even though we paskin like Rabbi Yirmiyah, which would be posel, the ktav sofer and an eid echad, but we will not be machshir the chatam sofer ve'eid echad like the shita of Rabbi Yirmiyah because of the problem in Rabbi Yossi's shita where we say, bo'omer imru, when he gives instructions to the shlichim to give instructions to others, Rabbi Yossi says it does work, and from that problem is, maybe the signature of the sofer here is only because of embarrassment, and not because the Baal really instructed him to do so. Tav chanichato v'chanichata kasher. If they use, quote-unquote, their nicknames, then it is kasher. Now, whether this is referencing the parties to the get, or the edim on the get is not clear. Over here it seems to be as a machloket Rashi and Tosafot. I mentioned yesterday it could be either way. Where it says, Tanu Rabbanan, chanichat avot begitin ad yudurot. If you use the nickname of the family, that is good for 10 generations. Shimon ben Elazar omer gimel dorot, for 3 generations, kasher, it's good, mikan ve'elech, pasul. From there forward, it is problematic. So here you have the individual not using their name, and seemingly over here it's not using their proper name at all, but rather just the family name. The family was known by this nickname, or usually it's by an important patriarch of the family that they take on the name of the patriarch, and all the people in the family use that as their calling card or as their signature. So now, that is good as long as there's an association between the family name or the patriarch of the family and this individual. What we're seeing here is that the Tana Kama believes that that is true for 10 generations, whereas the Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says it's only true for 3 generations that we associate that name with the individual. Now, if it also involves their personal name, then it seems that it's much less of a problem, because there, when you have their personal name plus the nickname, quote-unquote, or the family name, then it's not just the family name, and that association can last much longer, the same way that our surnames would stay with us today for a much longer period of time, as long as you have your proper name or your personal name that's associated with it. On the other hand, if you're just using the family name, that's where they're discussing where is the family name still relevant to such a person, or where are they still known by that family name. Rashi says over here, ad yudorot, lo mifsala, then the get is not pasold, mahave kishina shmo ushma. That we have a problem of changing the names of the parties in the get. So what's clear is that Rashi thinks that this chanichaton, chanichata, are going on the name of the man and the woman in the get. And we don't say that it's pasul because of shina shmo, shina shma, when you use the chanicha instead of their proper names. Rashi likely learns that out from the fact that it has a male and female conjugation, which we're referring to the parties of the get. When you're talking about edim, you're not going to be talking about women in the edim. So chanichato and chanichata would not be relevant. The Balia Tosafot, on the other hand, say, you can see this in the Kachayu Nikia Dat Yerushalayim Kotvim. The end of the Mishnah, it says, this is the way that the people in Yerushalayim used to sign. Rashi on the Mishnah said, that means that they used to sign their name, so-and-so, Ben, so-and-so, and they did not put the word Eid in there. Right. They use it for brevity. They left out the word eight. Here, Tosafot disagrees with Rashi. But in disagreeing with Rashi, you also see from this that he had a different interpretation of Chanichato and Chanichata, which is, Shaloa Yukotvim ele Ish Ploni Ben Ploni. That's Rashi's view. Rabbeinu Hanano, V'chein Rabbeinu Tam Garse, Chanichato V'chanichata Kasher. V'kacha Yunikei Adat Yerushalayim Kotvim. Perish, Shaloa Yukotvim ele Chanichatam V'chanichata Vot. That they didn't write anything besides their nickname and their family's name. The Gemara lo ayri b'chanichata ish k'dahacha elichanicha mishpacha nikreit al shema. Tosafot's raya is that the Gemara over here is not talking about this person's nickname, but rather the nickname of the family, and therefore we're talking about the edim that are signed on it. That female conjugation of chanichata is not because it's referencing the woman, but rather referencing the mishpacha, which is nikheva, and the anichata shel hamishpacha. And that's why it's written in the female form, because the Gemara here is clearly talking about the family nickname, not about this individual's name. Rashi himself on the Mishnah says, Shem Levi Shal Mishpacha Kula. Rashi himself on the Mishnah seems to indicate that it is a nickname for the family, which is along the lines of the interpretation of Tosafot, but here Rashi seems to say that it's referencing the parties to the get. Here Tosafot says it's referencing the Edim, and the Nikiei Adat in Yerushalayim used to sign with their family name. Now, whether you read the Tosafot, that it's Hachinachato V'Hanichata, that they signed it with their nickname and their family's nickname, meaning that both of them were necessary, or is that or? Did they sign with their nickname or their family's nickname? That's not clear, then, according to Tosafot, whether it means one or the other, or both of them are necessary. But Tosafot clearly sees this referencing the Edim, and not the parties to the get. And again, then he says that's what Nikiei Adat Yerushalayim used to do. Not that they left out the word aid, but this part, the kach Nikiei Adat, is connected to the chanicha, because they moved that statement of kach ayu Nikiei Adat Yerushalayim down to the bottom of the Mishnah. And therefore, it's after this statement about the nicknames. And it's saying that they used to write with their quote-unquote nicknames, they signed with their family name or their family's insignia, not with their personal name, or again, with Tosafot, maybe it's their personal name and their family name, but that's what the Kach Nikiei Adat Yerushalayim, you will see him, is referencing. Not the issue of leaving out the word aid or not leaving out the word aid, but rather this part of the Mishnah. But here again, you see that Tosafot sees the nicknames referring to the Edim, not to the parties to the get. Now we have, Gemara says, Keman az lahad am Rabbi Chanina, following which position does this statement of Rabbi Chanina follow? Tav chanichat avot begitin ad gimel dorot. That chanichat avot only works for three generations. Come on, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, that's clearly like Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says, only up to three generations and not 10 generations. Amar v'una maikara. Again, if you're using your proper name plus this, it makes sense. If you're just using this, it would be, if a family member, if a father is very famous. Take examples of individuals who everybody knows. Whether it's now, because in the news, Trump, or Gates. Those are names that are well known. So the child and the grandchild, according to Rabbi Shimon Lazar, you may not even know their name. Just say, that's a Gates, or that's a Trump. But for now, in the colloquial, where people are calling him Trump, they're using that nickname, not because his father was called that. It's because he has a certain amount of recognition, and that name, recognition, now will apply to him, his children, and his grandchildren, because people will associate them with him directly. By the time you get past his grandchildren, already, yeah, we remember he was, you know, the famous Trump. So it could go on for longer, but that's why I'm saying that the people generally associate the children and the grandchildren with that party, and they'll use the name of the grandfather to associate with them. Once you get to the great-grandchildren, you're in a generation that doesn't know great-grandfather, or most of them have not bumped into him, therefore there's less association. Sometimes the name persists, and that's probably what the Tanakama's position is. If they keep using it, if it persists, then fine. Others will say, no, you're already into a generation that's not connected back to the original party. And to them, that name has no meaning. Like today, that the children of today's age, the word Kennedy means nothing to them. Whereas for people of our generation, Kennedy, that's a name that you'd automatically associate with the family. So there is this idea that you have it for a certain amount of time, and then after the fourth, third generation, they don't have any association with the name because they never lived it during a period where the name had any meaning. All right, my kara, what's the pasuk? Ki tolid banim uvnei banim v'noshantem. Because it says, when you give birth to banim, uvnei banim, meaning three generations, v'noshantem, and then it gets old. So that When is it considered to be old, or when is it considered to be after a long time period? That's after you have banim and bnei banim. If they have children and grandchildren, so that's the three generations that we speak about, that's hinted to over here. Amar Rabbi Shimon Levi, Lo charva Eretz Yisrael ad she'avdu ba zayin batei dinim avodah zarah. That Eretz Yisrael was only destroyed after seven courts worshipped avodah zarah. Now the way that Rashi explains this doesn't mean literally courts, not in the sense of a place of adjudication, but courts in the sense of a king's court, right? The court of the king. I'm playing on the words. That's not, they really say batei dinim. Rashi just says that the batei dinim are associated with the court of the king because in that day, the king was also an arbiter, and that he was supposed to do tzedakah u'mishpat, that we see in the Navi, in the instructions to the Malachim of Yehuda, that the Navi says you have to act properly, you have to carry out justice, and that was part of the job of the king, was to ensure that there was a fair court system and fair adjudication being done in his empire. So what the Gemara is suggesting here, according to Rashi, is that there were seven dynasties of kings, and those seven dynasties were worshipping Avodah Zarah. And that's not true in Yehuda, because Yehuda is all one dynasty. It's all from David HaMelech. The king is never overturned. Where you have that is in the Malchei Yisrael. Because the Malchei Yisrael, by definition, are breakaway from Yehuda. And then you have Yerovam ben Nevat, who's the first, and then his family. And then his family is wiped out, and then the family of Omri takes over. You have different families coming in because there's no lineage, or they call shoshelet of the kings, because there's no permanent shoshelet. So he says that there are turnovers in the dynasties, and those turnovers in the dynasties are what generate the seven over here. Ve'elohein, Yerovam ben Nevat. Yerovam ben Nevat, of course, is the first in his family, because Yerovam ben Nevat is the first king of Israel. U'Basha ben Achya. And then the next one is the king of Israel, Basha ben Achya. V'achav ben Omri. V'yehu ben Nimshi. Upechach ben Ramalayahu, Menachem ben Gadi, Voshea ben Elah. Right, so these are the seven. Yerovam ben Nevat is easy, and so is Hoshea ben Elah, because Hoshea ben Elah is the last king of Israel before he is run over by the Ashurim. So the ones in between are not as simple. Yehu is also a very straightforward one, because there Yehu is instructed to wipe out the house of Achav, and then take over, and he takes over. So there's another family exchange. Now, Achav ben Omri is problematic because Omri, his father, was the first king and not Achav. Achav is the second king in that dynasty, not the first king in that dynasty, because it's Achav ben Omri. So why is he being named as the beginning of that familial line rather than his father Omri? Rashi over here notes that there are exceptions to this rule, because also in the time of Basha ben Achia, there's also an Omri. In that time period, there are a number of kings that fill in. There are a couple of revolts, and then in those revolts, the kings are then turned over very quickly. And so Rashi sets up a principle that if a king ruled for less than a year, it doesn't count. That's not called a dynasty. That's not called a new Beit Din. You have to establish a certain amount of presence. You have to rule, and not only rule, but seemingly pass that rule to one's child. And then the case of Achav ben Omri, he says over here, because Achav was so bad, therefore they counted him instead of his father. So even though his father's the beginning of the dynasty, since Achav was such a rasha, and he did much worse than his father, they called his dynasty on his name. I would more likely say that his rule turns out to be the peak of the northern kingdom. It's the case in which Yehoshaphat is ruling in parallel with Achav, and they have a treaty between them. Until that point in time, the two kingdoms have been fighting, and after that time they'll end up fighting. But during that period of time, there is a treaty between and almost a bringing of the Eretz Yisrael back to the status of what it was under Shlomo HaMelech, where you have this unified, greater Israel because of the connection between Yehoshaphat and Achav, and that produces a tremendous kingdom at the time, a powerful kingdom where Edom, Moab are all subjugated to Bnei Yisrael, and in the end, in Achav's time, they also end up defeating Aram. So there's tremendous both military successes as well as expansiveness in terms of territory. And because of that unification, it's likely that his Shoshelet is called after his name because of the successes of the dynasty under his rule rather than under his father's rule. Now the Gemara says, Shinamar, how do we know this? Umlala yoledet hashiv'a nafcha nafsha ba It's not in the Navi, there's no hey there. It's ba shimsha ba'od yomam bosha vechafeira. So this umlala yoledet, right? This poor individual or this Nebuch, right? What? Right, low life, what? It's Nebuch yoledet hashiv'a, that they give birth to seven. Nafcha nafsha, her soul is distraught. Ba shimsha ba'od yomam, the sun sets while it's still day out. Bosha v'chafeira, they are embarrassed and disgraced. What's described over here is umlula yoledet hashiva, that it gives birth to seven, and then those seven, the sun sets on those seven, and they are embarrassed and disgraced. So the seven is referring to the seven sholshalot ha-melucha, the seven batei dinim, and the embarrassment is that they worship the avodah zarah, which causes the destruction of Israel. Amar Avami, Maikara. Again, what's the pasuk that supports this? Ki tolid banim ubnei banim. They use the same pasuk, which is the Kriyat Torah on Tisha B'Av. Ki lo tolid banim ubnei banim noshantem ba'aretz in Parshat Elchanan. And then it says, v'noshantem, v'ishchatem, and then v'avadtem. That you will then, after noshantem, get old in the land, and you'll go off v'ishchatem. You'll leave the path, and you will act inappropriately. What's that inappropriate is avodah zarah. So here it's describing ki tolid. Now how you read this, over here it's brought in the Tosafot. Ki tolid is one, banim is two, ubnei is two, banim is two. So you have seven. That's how to read it. Ki tolid, banim, ubnei, banim. That's one way to get to the seven. The other possibility is ki tolid, banim is two, bnei banim is two. So that's four. And then it has the verbs. Vinoshantem, vishchatem, vavatem. So those three verbs get you to seven. So those are the two possibilities where you get to the seven generations. Amar Rav Kana, Rav Asi, the Rav. So Rav Kana, Rav Asi said to Rav, Tivbe Bilshea ben Elah. Hoshea ben Elah is the last king of Israel. Vayasa Rav Enei Hashem. He did evil or improper acts in front of Hashem. Rak lokumachei Israel. It just wasn't as bad as the Malchei Yisrael. Uchtiv, Alav, Allah, Shalmaneser. And it says about him that Ashur, Shalmaneser, who's the king of Ashur, comes and overrides him. So, it makes no sense, which is, here, he was better than all the kings that came before him, and yet, he's the one who's finally kicked out, and when the Ashur comes and conquers Yisrael and puts them into exile. So how could the Pasuk be telling you that he's better? And for that reason, he's the one who goes into exile. So I'm like, oh, otan pardiseot, shoshiv Yeravam ala drachim, kadei shelo yayu Yisrael aregel, Yeravam ben Nevat, when he breaks away from Yehuda and establishes the kingdom, he also realizes that if the religious center remains in Yerushalayim and the political seat of Yehuda is in Yerushalayim, then if everybody in the end has to go religiously aliyah aregel to Yerushalayim, then it will always give more credence or power to the Malchei Yehuda because their seat of government is in the same place of the seat of the Mikdash or the Kedusha. So he realizes that and says, I need to cut off the religious aliyah to Yerushalayim so that Yerushalayim is no longer a religious center, therefore giving credence to the Malchei Yehuda. So therefore he invents a holiday in the month of Cheshvan and he sets up the Agalim in Beit El Vidan. And he has the people worshipping those and wiping out Aliyah the regal and puts up guards on the roads to prevent the people from going to Yerushalayim for the regal. So Hoshea ben Elah wipes out or eliminates them. So everybody else had those guards there not to be Aliyah the regal. He finally takes them away. Ba Hoshea ubitlan. Hoshea comes and takes them away. Ba'afel b'kin lo alu Yisrael the regal. Even though the guards were no longer there, the people of Israel didn't go up to the regel. So until now, they were anasim. They were exempt because it wasn't their fault. There were guards that they couldn't go up to Yerushalayim. But now that the guards are gone and they don't go up to Yerushalayim, well, we can't say that had they had the opportunity to go up to Yerushalayim, they would have gone. It's not blamed on Hoshea. It's just the reason why the Churban of Israel and the Galut Yisrael happens then. It's because then that's the final straw that breaks the camel's back. Because after he did the right thing, which is he took away the guards, the people didn't take up the opportunity to go up to the regel. And that's the problem. Oh, so that's the same thing as used by people who say, well, if one has to go to work and one has all these things in life that take up their time, and therefore they are exempt from learning Torah, because there are actually 2 days with this. So then, if you do not learn Torah during your free time, it is mar'eh on what you would do with the remainder of the time. If you make the claim that I'm anus, that I am, it's not my fault, I have to go to work, I have to take care of these, I'm a human being, I have to take care of these things in life, and therefore it takes up my time and I can't learn Torah around the clock. But then when you get free time, what do? If you learn Torah, then that reflects on the other part of time and says you really are an anus. The reason you're not learning these other time periods is because you are compelled to take care of other issues. On the other hand, if you're in your free time, you don't learn Torah as well, then you can't make the claim that I was anus during the periods of time when I'm working. Because even when you had free time, you didn't learn. Same thing over here. As long as you can't go up to the regel, you can make the claim. I would have gone up to the regel, and therefore, you can't hold me accountable. But once they take away the guards, and you don't go up, not only does that implicate you in terms of now, it also implicates you for the past, which says that it wasn't the guards that were holding you back, because now when the guards are gone, you wouldn't go up. Now, the truth is that it's not so simple, because this is hundreds of years of there being guards there, or of the prevention of the people going up the regel. They don't maybe not even known that there was an Aliyah the regel, or a necessity for an Aliyah the regel. Saying that you have to take a little bit of a grain of salt here, because it was imposed for so long that they might not even know that it was Aliyah the regel. But here, the Gemara implicates them, similar to the way, again, with Bittul Torah, if you can implicate a person if they don't use their free time to learn, then how can you make an argument that the reason I didn't learn in the other periods of time is because of Manus? So again, that might go with the Shita, not like the Gra, who suggests that you're only obligated to learn during your free time, but the one who says you're obligated to learn all the time, but you have excuses that free you from that obligation. But that can only be good if excuses, if then during your free time or the time when you don't have the excuse, you do learn. But if you don't learn in either period, you can't make a claim that I have an excuse that when I'm working, I don't learn, because even when you're not working, you don't learn. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Otam Shanim Shlo Yisrael L'Regel, Yalchu B'Shevi. Says, but those years that Bnei Yisrael did not come up to the regel, Yalchu B'Shevi, they should go into exile to make up for the fact that they really wouldn't have gone anyway. And so now they're going to go into exile to pay the price for not being Ola the regel, or basically not acknowledging that Hashem is a ruler, owner of the land, and we're just there by His good graces. So then they go into Shevi. We also see that later on in the time of Chizkiyahu, where they lead the religious revival and have a Korban HaPesach in Yerushalayim. Over there, he sends around people to cities that are not just in Yehuda, but cities that are in Israel. So it seems to be there was a remnant of Israel even after Ashur, or according to Chazal, Yirmiyahu brought the Aseret HaShvatim back, and that's why he's sending out the Shlichim to those areas. But in that case, those people were not coming up to Aliyah the Regel. And that might be the reference over here, that even when they were given the opportunity, even after all this happened, that those cities or those areas of Israel didn't bother to come up to Yehuda, and they did not come up to Aliyah the Regel. Amrav Chista Amar Ukva, V'amri La Amrav Chista Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah, Dorosh Remeimar, Mai Dichtiv, what is meant by the Paskuk, Vayishkod Hashem Al Hara'ah, So, it seems to be a pasuk that does not make sense, which is, as Rashi says over here, the meaning of the word vayishkod, shkeda, is to be focused on something. Now, Rashi says over here that it's not just to be focused, but also a deftness in that, which is vayimaher, that you do it quickly. Not only you're focused about it, but you also make sure to happen quickly. So it says, vayishkod Hashem al ra'ah, according to Rashi, means that he was focused on quickly bringing the bad, and then he brought it upon us, because Hashem, our God, is righteous. Because Hashem is so righteous, then he was focused and quickly brought the bad to us. Doesn't make so much sense. God did a good thing or tovah for Bnei Yisrael. That Galut Tzidkiyahu is the Churban Abayit. Galut Yechanya is when Nebuchadnezzar is Ole Al Eretz Yisrael, conquers Eretz Yisrael. There's another 11 years that sit between the Galut Yechanya and the Galut of Tzidkiyahu, meaning that he's appointed as a puppet king of Nebuchadnezzar, and eventually Tzidkiyahu rebels against Nebuchadnezzar, and that brings Nebuchadnezzar back to Yerushalayim to wipe out the Mikdash and wipe out Jerusalem. So the galut of Tzidkiyahu happens when the galut of Yechoniah is still extant. Because with the galut of Yechoniah it says, Hacharash v'amazger elef. So it says that the people that went into the galut Yechoniah, it describes them as the Harash and the Mazger. So what is the Harash and the Mazger that are being mentioned here? It doesn't necessarily mean woodworkers and other types of professions. Rather, the Gemara says, Harash Shibashash Putrim Nasuakol Kharashim. These are individuals when they opened up, meaning they spoke, everybody else was made hear, whether it means they were made silent or that they could not hear. You could look at it either way. Either they could not understand or get to the depth of understanding of what these people were saying, or they couldn't hear anything else because it was so convincing, or that they're silenced, that they couldn't say anything, that we couldn't retort because these people were so well-versed in halacha and so erudite that these individuals couldn't respond. Masger, kevin shesogrim, shuvim inan putchim. That when they bring closure, you don't open it up again. The way Rashi reads that is, if they don't know the answer, then nobody knows the answer. Or the other way around, you could say is, once they give a psak halacha, that was definitive and nobody could question it or nobody had the ability to overturn it. Bekama, how many of them were there? Elef. Or in other words, the way the Chazal read this, this is the beginning of Galut Bavel, and that the Chachamim are put into Galut during the time of Yechoniah, and they basically establish the Jewish presence in Bavel, open up the yeshivot, the Batei Knesiot, which eventually when the Galut Tzidkiyahu comes, they have somewhere to go. And they have the institutions already established. The Torah is not lost because it's already been reestablished in Bavel by the time the Churban Abayit takes place. Ula Amar, Shigdim Shtei Shanim Lo Noshantem. That the reason that Hashem was so generous is that He brought it 2 years earlier than Venoshantem, which is similar to the idea that is brought by Churban Abayit. Where the Midrash brings the same thing, it says that Hashem did us a tovah in the Churban Abayit, because He took out His anger on the bricks and the stones, rather than on us. And so the same idea here, that Hashem put us into Galut, or brought the destruction before it would have been our end. So now the way that they read this is, Binoshantem. Noshantem be Gematria. You can work out the Gematria. You have a Tuf there is 400. You have a Mem is 40. You have a Nun is, another 50 is 490. You have a Shin, which is 300, is 790. Then you have another Nun, which is another 50, is 840. And then you have two Vavs, is 12, is 852. Right? 852 years. So it says there, Vinoshanten, Bishchatem, that if you do that and you get worship of Avodah Zarah, God's going to destroy you completely. That's if you get to 852 years. When does the Churban HaBayit take place? We know that Shlomo HaMelech builds the Beit HaMikdash 480 years after Bnei Yisrael leave Mitzrayim. That's mentioned explicitly in Sefer Melachim. 480 years after they left Mitzrayim, the Beit HaMikdash is built. The Beit HaMikdash is extant for 410 years for the first Beit HaMikdash. 410 plus 480 is 890. Well, that doesn't work out. So 890, except there were 40 years they were in the Midbar. 40 years they were in the Midbar, they couldn't worship Avodah Zarah, or they didn't worship Avodah Zarah, or they weren't worshiping Avodah Zarah in Eretz Yisrael. To back out from 890, 40 years, that's 850. And that's what Ula is saying over here. 2 years before Venoshantim. 852 years would have been when you get old there, and that would have led to the complete destruction of Klal Yisrael. So Hashem is Makdim 2 years, and at the 850th year, puts him into Galut, and the Tova is that had he waited another 2 years, it would have led to the utter destruction of Klal Yisrael. So instead here, it's 850 years, and that's why Bnei Yisrael survived the punishment, or able to go on. And that's the Tova that is being done here, according to Ula. The first answer was that Galut Tzidkiyahu was overlapping with Galut Yechoniah. The second answer, which Ula presents, is that he did it at 850 years and not 852 years, which would have led to the utter extinction of Bnei Yisrael. So he was makdim it for 2 years. Amar Avacha Bar Yaakov Shma Mina Mehira Demari Alma. From here you see that when God says something's going to happen quickly, Tam Nemei Avachamshim Etartehu. That's 852 years. In God's perspective, the way Rashi reads this over here, Kaminyan Venoshantem. It says there, Ki Avod Tovedun Maher, that you're going to be quickly wiped out from the land. So therefore, what do you see? What is quickly that you're going to be wiped out from the land? After 852 years, that's when you're going to be wiped out from the land. Tosafot points out the weakness in Rashi's pshat over here, which is, Vim tomar, neish mishnechnus ud aretz, achiyatsu kach, that when they came into the land, till the time they were put into exile, it's 850 years. But who says that they were worshiping Avodah Zarah all that time? Time of Yoshua, the time of the Zekenin, the time of David HaMelech, they're not worshiping Avodah Zarah. So how do you know? Why is it that they're worshiping Avodah Zarah from the first day? That's number one. And number two is that the Maher here is not modifying the even Oshantem, it's modifying the Avod Tovedun. That after that period of time, then when I decide I'm going to destroy you, I'm going to destroy you quickly. The quickly is not referencing how fast from the beginning you're going to be destroyed. It's once the decree comes, then it'll happen quickly. So the Maher is not modifying the time period in which it takes to get to that point. So Tosafot, for that reason, doesn't necessarily like Rashi's interpretation. The Rabbeinu Tam, in defense of that, says there was a Avodah Zarah from the time that they came into Eretz Yisrael because of Pesach Micha. According to the Midrash, the Pesach Micha came with them through the Midbar and then into Eretz Yisrael. Then Avodah Zarah started from the moment they entered into Eretz Yisrael. That's one possibility, but it only addresses one of the two concerns over here. The other possibility is based on what we say in Vayayim Shamoah, which is Vavadta Meira Me'al Aretz HaTovah. The Maher that they're referring to here is not the Maher that's found in the Psukim by Ki Tolid Banim Ubnei Banim, but rather the Mehira that is found by Vayayim Shamoah. That if you worship Avodah Zarah, God's going to wipe you out quickly. Well, what do we see here? You worship Avodah Zarah, it took Hashem 850 years, or 852 years, to wipe you out. So God's perspective on time is a little different than our perspective on time. All right, next Mishnah. Next Mishnah is a very, very fundamental Mishnah that has tremendous application today from two perspectives. Get mi'useh bi'Yisrael kasher. A get that is compelled by a Jewish court is kasher. But ovdei kochavim, if it's done by a non-Jews, pasul, it's problematic. Ube'ovdei kochavim choftim oto, if the ovdei kochavim are beating him, ve'omrim lo, and they're telling him, aseh mash Yisrael omrim lecha, do what the Beit Din of Israel said to do, then we don't have this girsa. You can see it was taken out, but the girsa in front of most of Ishonim is kasher. Then that is a good get, and that's not a problem. So here, you have a number of items. One is, the ability to compel a get exists, but that compelling of the get can only be done by a Beit Din Israel, and not a Beit Din of Ovdei Kochavim. Unless the Ovdei Kochavim are acting in a sense as shlichim, or at the behest of the Beit in Israel. Arav Nachman Amar Shmuel. Get ha-me'useh b'Yisrael k'din kasher. A get that is forcibly garnered through a Jewish court and is done properly is kasher. Shelo k'din, if it's done improperly, pasul. The get is pasul, but uposel. It still is posel. Posel here means that it has a reach get. And this woman can't marry a kohen anymore, even though she has a pasul get. If the ovdei kochavim kedin, if the ovdei kochavim do it properly, pasul, it's still a pasul get, uposel. And it also ruins the woman that she can't marry a kohen. Shelo kedin, if they do it improperly, afil reach get emo. Then there is no reach get at all. Right, so now, kedin and shelo kedin. When is it appropriate to compel a get? And when is it not appropriate to compel a get? Rashi says here, there are code words in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, for instance, Yotzi v'yitein ktubah. Where the Mishnah says that he has to divorce her and give her a ktubah. So in those cases, the Beit Din can compel him to conform to the halacha. In other cases where we're not able to do that because he's not obligated or compelled to give a get by the halacha, then we can't compel him just to give a get. Again, there is the institution of the Geonim, called Moredet. That institution, the Geonim, is that if a woman wants out of a marriage, that we will compel the husband to give a get, Kofino to give a get. The Rabbeinu Tam and Simili Rashi as well seem to not like that and reject that institution of compelling a get when the woman just wants out of the marriage. And therefore, it goes through a period of time when that is enforced in that manner. And then it seems to fade into the background where Beit Din stops compelling Gitin when the woman just wants out of the marriage. I just say this. I heard this from Rabbi Meir Lichtenstein that there might be a connection between the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom and the issue of Moredet. The issue of meredith is empowering the woman to get a divorce. The problem is that if a woman is in a marriage and she, for instance, isn't having children, so the husband wants to take a second wife in order to have children, which, first of all, the Gemara in Yevamot speaks about is might be the proper way to deal with the situation, and he might be justified in doing so. But now, the first wife is trapped, because he says, I don't want to divorce you, I love you, it's just I can't have children, so I'm going to have another wife to have the children, but I still want you as my wife. So the woman is now trapped in that situation. So the idea of meredith from the Gaonim might have been that protection afforded to the women, that in situations where the husband's going to take a second wife, and where it's justified and for him to take, luckily for him to take a second wife, then we give the women an ability to get out of that marriage. We give them an exit so that they don't have to be stuck in a situation where he's taking a second wife. If you introduce the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom, where you're not allowed to marry two wives anyway, the necessity for that protection is not there because he can't marry a second wife. Now, what's clear is that the issue of meredith is not coming about to deal with the problem like with today, what we call aguna, which is just the simple parties want to get divorced and the refusal of the husband to give a get. That doesn't seem to be a justification for a divorce in their day because the woman just wants out. In all likelihood, for the woman at that time to leave a marriage and get divorced was almost as worse as being in the divorce itself when it was a difficult divorce. Being a divorcee in their society and being a single woman was probably a terrible lot in life, similar to what goes on in places like India today, where a divorcee's lives are miserable. So they might have stayed in the marriage. But in a case where there are two wives and it's an untenable situation for the woman, they gave her an exit. So therefore, from Meir Lichtenstein, there might be a connection between the two, which is that as the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom gains traction, the idea of meredith goes down or is then discarded. And so that in the time of the Gaonim, where meredith is important because you have multiple wives, by the time the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom, the time of Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi, where it's becoming much more widely accepted, then the need for this meredith, because nobody has two wives anymore, is less necessary. And that might lead to that division between the Ashkenazi and the Sephardi Poskim, where the Ashkenazi Poskim are rejecting this idea of meredith or don't like it, whereas the Sephardi Poskim are following the Gaonim and keeping it intact, at least for a period of time. Now the Gemara says, Manavshach. I don't understand what's going on here in the Gemara. If the non-Jewish courts can compel a get, and it'll be a kosher get, then let them compel the get, and it'll be a kosher get. If they are unable to compel a get, then why, when they give a get, or a get is done in this manner, does that get posel the woman le'akuhuna? So now, either they can do it, or they can't do it. If they can do it, and that's why the get makes her pasul de kuhuna, they make it mutar de gamre. I mean, say that get is a proper get. If they can't do it, I mean, halachically they're prevented, or it's not a good get when they compel it, then why does it posel her le kuhuna? It's not a good get, even a semblance of a get over here. Samar Mishashia, Dvar Torah, get muvseh b'ovdei kochavim kasher. It's an unbelievable position, but Rav Mishashia believes that mina Torah, a non-Jewish court that compels a get is a kosher get. If it was an appropriate case where they should have compelled a get, and they do compel a get, mina Torah, it's kosher according to Rav Mishashia. Uma atam amru pasul. So then why don't they allow the non-Jewish courts to do this? Shalotei kol achat v'achat holechet v'tola atzma b'ovid kochavim. Because what we don't want people to do is that women who want to get out of their marriages, what they're going to do is hire a non-Jewish thug and have him come along and beat up the husband until he gives a get. Or in other words, she's going to use the non-Jewish court system to her advantage. And we don't want that. We don't want that access to the non-Jewish court system to allow her to get out of the marriage by using the non-Jewish court system. Assuming, or the assumption being, that they're not necessarily going to follow the letter of the law of halacha, or they're not necessarily going to care about halacha, and they're going to compel the husband to give a get, even a kosher get, but not in circumstances where they're supposed to, or even in circumstances where they're supposed to, they're going to do it to appease the woman, who doesn't necessarily an impartial party here. And so therefore we don't want them engaging in this. Mufkad that smabi ad balan, that's how she's going to get out of her marriage. So my says, Iochi, Shalokidin, Afriach Re'echa Get Einbo. What are you going to do with the second part? By the Beit in Israel, if they do it properly in a proper case, then it's a good get. When they do it in an improper case, then it's not a good get. The get is pasul, but it has a Re'echa Get. By the Ovdei Kochavim, you say that it's pasul in the first case because even though technically they can force a get when it's kedin, nevertheless we posel it because of this gezerah or this takanat chachamim. But that means in the case where they compel it improperly, why doesn't it have the same din as a Jewish court? Which is okay, the get is pasul, but it should still have reyach get that's associated with it. Now have a shlok kedin ki Israel, and it should be the equivalent of a shlok kedin where you improperly force a get by a Jewish court. Umafsil nami lifsol. And it should also be pusel the woman in that case. Ella means we just rejected what we said before. That means that Rav Misharsha's statement that mina Torah, a non-Jewish court can compel a get, is not true. Ella had Rav Misharsha bedutahi. That which Rav Misharsha said is a joke. It was, whether it was a way to test the Talmidim, it was a suggestion that wasn't real. The time am I. So then what is the real reason over here? Kedin, b'chedin d'Yisrael michlaf. The reason is that if a get is properly extracted in a Jewish court, that will get mixed up with the case where they properly extract it from a non-Jewish court. And so therefore they wanted to impose on that get a certain semblance of Re'ach HaGet because it could get confused with a Jewish court. If it's taken out by a Jewish court properly, then that is a good get, and it's posel, the Re'ach HaGet is posel. The non-Jewish court, if they compel on that case, technically it's meaningless. It has no meaning. The get is an ois get, has no meaning as a get. But if we say that, what people are coming to think is that when you force a get, even in a proper circumstance, it's not a get at all. They won't make the distinction between the non-Jewish court and the Jewish court. And they'll say, even when a Jewish court does it, it's not a good get. And that's not true. So in order for people to understand that, we said, even when a non-Jewish court does it, kedin, and it's a pasul get and it has no meaning, we'll still say the get has a reyach again, it's pasul bikuna, to show you that there is an instance when, if you compel a get, it will work. It has to be a Jewish court, it has to be done kedin, but that'll get confused by a kedin by a non-Jewish court. Shalo kedin, b'chedin d'Yisrael o michlaf. The other case, when they do it improperly, that's not going to get mixed up with the case of Israel or as a regular case where the Jewish court is properly compelling the get, and this is where Rashi says it becomes a gzeira l'gzeira. The whole reason that we worry about the non-Jewish court doing a kedin is because of the Jewish court that does a kedin. So then if you're going to start worrying about a non-Jewish court that does a shalom kedin, the only reason we worry about it there is because of a possibility of the Jewish court doing bedin. But that means that it's passing through. Non-Jewish court wrongly extracts a get. We're going to worry about that because of a non-Jewish court that properly extracts a get. And we're only worrying about that because of a Jewish court that extracts a get properly. So there's a gzeira, the gzeira, and therefore over there in the case shalom kedin by Ovid Kuchavim, they made it into nothing. There's no semblance. It's pasul, obviously, to get, but it's also not pusel because it's meaningless to get in that case. So now, Abaye Ashkecha de Rav Yosef, diyotiv v'ka maseh b'giti. We had a case, Abaye finds Rav Yosef, his Rebbe, that is compelling the giving of gitin. Amalei v'anan hejotot anan. Aren't we just lay people, meaning that we don't have smicha? We don't have smicha, how are we compelling gitin? Betanya, haya Rabbi Tanya the Tarfan Omer. Kol makom shata motze aguriot shel ovdei kochavim. Anytime you find aguriot means to cluster, to gather, to store. Or in other words, it means a gathering of sorts or a court. Here it means a place of adjudication of the non-Jews. Afo pishi dineam ki dinei Yisrael. Even if they adjudicate the law exactly the same way that the Jewish courts do it, you are not allowed to enter that system or use that system. Shinemar, ve'elam mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem. These are the mishpatim that you place before them. Lifneihem, v'lo lifnei ovdei kochavim. You're allowed to adjudicate these dinim in front of a Jewish court, not in front of a non-Jewish court. Davar acher, lifneihem, v'lo lifnei hodyotot. That you can adjudicate this in front of a properly ordained court, meaning a court that has smicha, velo lifnei hejotot, and not before lay people. Rashi claims over here that even though Parshat Mishpatim is written after Mamad Har Sinai, and at the end of Parshat Mishpatim in Perek Chav Dalet in Shmot, over there it talks about Moshe going up to God and his kenim being there, and Rashi says from the ayin zakenim you learn out that you need smicha, because of the association of the ayins, the kenim that are together with Moshe, they are the ones who are the tasim lifnehem. They're the ones who, in front of whom you bring your adjudication. This is Rashi the Shitato, that ain't mukdam u'muchar b'Torah, and therefore, Perech Avdalit in Sefer Shmot, which is after Parashat Mishpatim, Rashi thinks that that belongs before Mamad Har Sinai, and it's connected back to Perek Yutet in Shmot, in Parashat Yitro, which is Mamad Har Sinai. And Rashi sees them as being the same story. The Ramban, the Ibn Ezra, and others say that's not correct. Mukdam u'muchar b'Torah, and the story at the end of Mishpatim is post Mamad Har Sinai. But either way, the Mishpatim Asher Tasim Lifneim is governed by that. For them, you could also argue, and this is what the Balei HaTosafot argue, that it has nothing to do with the Ayin Zkenim at the end of Parshat Mishpatim, but rather to where the fact that the in Parshat Mishpatim it uses the word Elohim to reference the judges. And we know that when you use the word Elohim to reference to judges, that means someone who is samuch, has smicha. And that's the definition of a judge that is called Elohim. It's very important also, just theologically and hashkafically, that a judge is known as Elohim, and God is also known as Elohim. And that the words are used, that a judge is, in a sense, acting like God, but also as the emissary of God in adjudicating the case. And that it goes to all the halachot that we have about judges having to cover their heads when they're doing a din, and that the Shekhinah is present at a din. All of those factors come from the fact that the word Elohim is used to describe God and judges. Now, for that reason, you need smicha. What Abaye is saying to Rabbi Yosef is, we need smicha in order to adjudicate these cases or compel a get. We don't have smicha here in Bavel, because there's no smicha in the Chutz Laaretz. If that's the case, how are you, Rabbi Yosef, compelling gitin in this case? Samalei, anan, shlichutayu, kaabdinan. It's a very famous line that we are the emissaries of the people in Eretz Yisrael. People in Eretz Yisrael have smicha, and we're acting under their auspices. Midahava hodaot v'halvaot. Similar to the cases of hodaot v'halvaot. Again, we'll get there in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Machloket Rashi and Tosafot, what hodaot and halvaot are. But let's assume it refers to loans and transactions. Iochi gzelot v'chavalot nami. How come we don't adjudicate cases of theft and damage, I mean bodily harm that is done by one individual to another individual? When we do their bidding, or basically we are emissaries of the smuchim in Eretz Yisrael, is in common cases. Cases that come up all the time. Hodot and halvaot come up all the time. And therefore we were empowered to act as emissaries of the courts in Eretz Yisrael, or the smicha in Eretz Yisrael. Gzelot and chavalot, which are less common, they did not empower us to do that. Tosafot over here says, Im tomar, v'amatzinu b'kama komo shehudanim gzelot v'chavalot. He brings examples in Shas, where they did do gzelot and chavalot. He says, Eish lomar, tiyu dochukim oto, ayidei dekavalei zimnal Eretz Yisrael. He used to compel it by setting a court date in Eretz Yisrael. That meaning that they would set the date to be in Eretz Yisrael. The party would not go, and then when he is a misareiv to go to court, then the courts can intervene in Bavel in order to compel him to do something. That the meaning over here, gzelot and chavalot, doesn't mean theft and chavalot and bodily harm, but rather gzelot ayidei chavalot. That ain't dani Bavel shechaval b'chavero v'gazalo. Has to be that exact case where he both stole from him and injured him, or he stole from him by injuring him. So that might be a unique case, and not all cases of zelot are exempt. But then the Gemara says, based on that, ki avdinan shluchutayo b'milta deshchicha. When do we do their bidding? When it's a common case. B'milta de lo shchicha, lo avdinan shluchutayo. In a case where it's not common cases, we do not do their bidding, we're not their emissaries. That's why hodot v'halvaot, yes, but gzelot v'chavalot, no. And as you noted, gitin are shchiach. And since gitin are shchiach, they are included or incorporated in this gzerah. And that's why Rav Yosef felt that he was able to do it. Tosafot also notes here, that's the same reason why we accept gerim today. Even though gerim require a beit din of mumchim, nevertheless, we still allow for gerut, because in essence what he says here is, yesh lamar, omeri davdinan shlichutayu dechashiv kishchicha. That here again we do their bidding, and it's considered to be shchiach, just like that of
hodot and havot and gitin, and that's why we still allow gerut to take place. Ve'im tomar, Tosfot says, heichi avdin and shlichutayu. How can we do their bidding or be their emissaries? V'achshav ein mumchim b'Eretz Yisrael. That's all good and dandy when there are mumchim or there's smicha in Eretz Yisrael. We can claim that we are emissaries or we are a derivative of those that have smicha in Eretz Yisrael. But if there's no one left in Eretz Yisrael with smicha, then how are we acting on their behalf if they're not even there to act on their own behalf? And what he says is, Ishlamar, Tishlichut dekamai avdinan. That this what we are doing the bidding of the original courts or the earlier courts that were there. This reminds us of somewhat akin to the establishment of the calendar that was put into force by those that had smicha when there was Kviyat HaChodesh al Pi HaRiyah in Eretz Yisrael, and they were mekadesh it forward. The mechanism of how it works is subject to machloket and Rishonim, but they were to put in place a calendar that then was mekadesh those days in the future, mekadesh the Chadoshim. And similarly over here, there's the same type of mechanism that's being used by which the original Batei Dinim and Eretz Yisrael empowered not only their generation, but the future generations to act on their behalf in order to adjudicate the laws, at least that are shchicha, al-pi dinei Torah. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah in order to take time to discuss two topics that we mentioned today's daf that has still have huge relevance in the modern day. One of which is get me'useh, that is a get that is brought about forcibly, and erka'ot shel goyim, going into the judiciary of non-Jewish courts. So the first, in terms of get me'useh, the Mishnah here tells us that a get me'useh b'din Yisrael is kasher. The question one has to ask is why? Why is it then when we compel the individual to give the get that it is a good get? That is discussed by the Gemara in Arachin on Daf Chof Aleph. It's also discussed by the Gemara in Baba Batra on Daf Mem Zayin. And in both those locations, the Gemara discusses a concept which is that kofin oto ad shomer rotze ani, that we compel him, we hit him until he says, yes, I want to do it. Now, that seems like a wonderful idea and a wonderful concept that we hit him until he says, yes, and I'll do it. But why does that work? In the end, when you compel a person to do something, that is not called that they do it kirtzono, out of their own free will. And therefore, why is a get mi'useh a get that is compelled to be given by the Beit Din? Why is it considered to be a good get? So over there, the Balei HaTosafot in Baba Batra speculate that maybe get has the same din as mecher. There the Gemara in Baba Batra says that if a person, it was a Gemara that we saw earlier in the Masechta with regards to if an individual is hung up on a tree and through that quote-unquote torture, they compel him to gift something to them or to sell something to them. There the Gemara in Baba Batra distinguishes between a case in which the individual sells to that person, or in a case where the individual gifts it. And the Gemara there says that if it's a matana, then we say that he definitely didn't want to do it. It was only because of the pressure that he ended up doing it. On the other hand, in the instance where he sells it, the Gemara says that agav unse gamar umakne, that because of the pressure that's placed on him, in the end he has gemirat hadat, he has a full conclusive action, that he is willing to sell this item, and he sells it with a full heart. So over there, the Ri wants to suggest that with Gitin, it might be the same thing. That anything that looks like mecher, anything that looks like a sale, will have the same effect as a sale, which is that even when you're compelling the individual to do it, it'll be considered as if they did it willingly, since there is a benefit in the sale. So for instance, that case where he sells it, he gets money in return for the sale, and therefore he has concluded that it's worth him selling this property, and then he's Gomera Maknet. And we also saw that by the sugya of the Sikri Kohen as well. So Tosafot suggests there that maybe we can say the same thing by the get. Migite nashim by the migmar minayu havinami kimon mecher. Sheniftar yedei kach mesher ksut vona. Since now the husband will be exempted from providing the obligations that he has to his wife of sher ksut vona. And therefore, it's equivalent of mecher. Giving the get is equivalent of selling something, because he's giving the get in exchange for the return of those obligations, or in essence, he's no longer obligated in those requirements, and there he got compensation for the fact that he gave the get. But then Tosfot says, "Aval yef shar lomar kein." Tosfot says, you can't say that's the reasoning. If that's the case, then even a get me'useh, shelo kedin, would be kasher. Because then even a get that's forced upon the individual when it's not justifiably forced upon him, that get would also be kasher. And therefore, the Ri, in the end, suggests that It doesn't have to do with the trade-off between Sher Ksuto Dona and Get, but rather, anything that you're obligated to do, it has the same din as a sale. And so, just like a person is chayav to bring a korban, we can compel him then to bring the korban. And just like a person is chayav to divorce his wife, therefore we can compel him to divorce his wife, because he is obligated in the matter. And if he's obligated in the matter, it's the equivalent of a sale, and he has gemira to dad and does it. On the other hand, if you do it shalokidin, if you do it improperly, then it has a din like a matana, like a gift, where he's only doing it to escape the problem, but he's not obligated to do this. And therefore, that will be unwound, or that will not be considered gemira to dad. And that's the way the Balei HaTosafot deal with this issue in the Gemara and Baba Batra, distinguishing between where you have an obligation to carry something out. There we deem it like mecher, and since it's like a mecher, therefore when we compel you to do it, it sticks, and there's gemira to dat. Whereas if you are not obligated to do it, and we compel you to do it, there's the equivalent of a matana, where you're doing it voluntarily, rather than because you're receiving something in return, or you're discharging an obligation, and that's why it doesn't stick, or that's why it doesn't work. A get meusek shlokadin doesn't work. And as we mentioned before in the Gemara, Kedin or Shlokedin depends on the halachot that we've seen throughout the Masechta, where there are times where the husband is compelled to give a get, and times where he's not compelled to give a get. And it has to be done, or adjudicated by Beit Din, to determine if he is chayav in the get. The more famous formulation of how this works is based on the Rambam in Hilchot Gerushin in Perek Bet, Halacha Chaf. Over there, the Rambam explains, how is it possible that if we're compelling him to do something, that's called rotzeani, that's called voluntarily giving the get. In the end, the Rambam explains it's because the person's inner will, or Yiddish in the Shema, in the end wants to do what is right, and wants to be mekayim the mitzvah. That's our whole purpose in life. That's what our neshamot want. They want to get closer to God. They want to do what God has commanded us to do. The only problem is that the Yetzer Hara, or other things, get in the way. And those things that get in the way prevent us from wanting to do the mitzvah, prevent us from doing the mitzvah. And what the Rambam says is that the kofinoto, when we whip him or when we compel him through force to give the get, what we are now doing is unifying his inner self with what he is supposed to be doing. Or in other words, his ritzon apnimi becomes now his ritzon achitzoni. That which his neshama wants now becomes what his body wants, because you've taken away any of the inhibitors to his carrying out what he's supposed to do or how he's supposed to act. And therefore, Rifikach, Ze Shein Rotze Legaresh, Machar Shu Rotze Liot Mi Yisrael, Rotze Hu Lasot Kol HaMitzvot. He wants to be a part of Klal Yisrael. He wants to do the mitzvot. Ulehitrachek Min Averot, and not do bad things. Vitzro Hu Shetakfo, but his Yetzer Hara has got a hold of him now. V'kevin Shuka, Ad Shetashash Yitzro. When you beat him, it's until that Yetzer is weakened, but my Rotze Ani, Kvar Garesh Liritzono. And when he says Rotzeoneni, then it's really what he wants deep down. And now you're unifying what he really wants deep down with what he is saying. And because of that, it's considered to be a voluntary get. Or anytime we say Kovin to Aichan Rotzeoneni, we are unifying between his inner compass and that which he's supposed to be doing, and taking away the Yetzer Hara that blocks it. You can see that here on this daf in the Tosafot Arid. And he notes here, the Tosafot Arid says, on the third to last line, on the right column, Perish, Afopish, Amar Rotzeani, Kevin Shlokidin, Isuoto. In the case where he says Rotzeani, and he says, I want to do it, but they did it improperly. Ve'ein kan mitzvah lishmoa divrei chachamim. And since over here there's no mitzvah to listen to the words of the chachamim, lo gamar v'yayiv b'choleiv. He doesn't have gemira to dad, and he doesn't give it with his full heart. Uposel b'truma, and then obviously the get is pasul, but it's still posel b'truma. What the Tosafot read says, or is reflecting the same idea that is presented here in the Rambam, which is that when you have a mitzvah, when you have a directive to listen to the words of the Chachamim, or you have a directive to do something, in that instance, when we are kofer you, that brings you in line with what you want to do, because deep down, that's exactly what you want to do, and we're getting rid of the Yetzer. But then, if there's no mitzvah, then when we hit you and you say yes in the end, the reason you're saying yes is not because your outer self is aligning with your inner self, and they have become one, because there's nothing or no mitzvah, and therefore your inner self is not compelled to do anything. And in that case, just because that, the only reason you're saying yes is because we physically beat you to the point where you're willing to say yes. but not because that yes connects with something deeper where you have to do it. And for that reason, it's not a get, or it's considered to be a get me'useh in the case where you do it shlo kedin, or it's done by an akum, because there's no din of mitzvah lishmo le divrei akum. There's only a mitzvah lishmo le divrei chachamim, and so because of that, it only works where the din is on their side, and there's a mitzvah lishmo le divrei chachamim. That's the way that the Rambam formulates it. And that's why in the case of the Mishnah, where the Akum specifically goes and beats him and says, do what the Israel told you to do, that's why it's kasher, that's why it works over there, because then you still have mitzvah lishma divrei chachamim. It's just that, that mitzvah lishma divrei chachamim is being compelled by the Akum, but it's not that he is forcing you to listen to him, he's forcing you to listen to the chachamim, and therefore the mitzvah still exists. Even though the Haggadot Mamoniot notes over there that there were others that interpreted the Mishnah, the last line of the Mishnah, to be defining where an Akum is Pasul. But majority of Rishonim, and the way that the Girsa of the Mishnah is, if you have the word Kasher in there, is that that is a good get. And the reason it's a good get is because of the fact that there's still a mitzvah lishma the divrei chachamim. So that's a background as to why a get me'useh works. Now, the Radvaz makes an important chiluk, which is the governing principle generally for giving a get under duress. So remember, in most instances where the husband is supposed to or obligated to give a get, those are cases that we have laid out here in the Gemara and Gitin. On the other hand, most of the instances where a husband is a recalcitrant husband and not giving a get, in those instances, he's not obligated to give a get. And therefore, you can't compel him, and you can't be kofe oto ad shemoy ratzani. That's number one. Number two is, we don't necessarily have the auspices of a Beit Din that can compel in that manner. But what we do have is we have the ability to put pressure on the individual. And the question, and it's a very important question, is at what point is it considered to be pressure that the person then makes a free choice and decides to give the get? Versus where is it that the pressure is so great that the individual only gives it because of the pressure, and then in the end it's not a voluntary get? And so the Radvaz lays out a basic principle, which, again, is a guiding principle throughout this issue of get me'useh, which is that, klalo de milso, the general principle is, kol zman shanshei shofet sham, as long as the people or the courts, individuals are there, even if he says, rotze ani kama pi'amim, even though he says, yes, yes, so many times, get me'useh, that is a forced get. V'machar shel chu anshei shofet, but if after the people who have been beating him up leave, v'nistalek onus, and then the pressure, the force is gone, shalu im tirtze legaresh, they ask him at that point, do you want to get divorced? V'amar rotze ani, if he says yes, then haget kasher. V'akalar taloi b'tzavar hachacham misader to get. And it's the obligation, the ball and chain, that is around the chacham who's preparing the get, ki yodeh im nistalek onus solo v'yichosh la'atzmo. And a chacham who's dealing with the get has to know whether when he said yes, the pressure was gone, or the pressure was still there. Or in other words, what the Radbaz is suggesting is that in instances where the individual has the ability to escape the pressure, then he's making a choice. And that's the way the Beit Yosef formulates it, which is that if you have a choice to accept the pressure or the penalty, or to give the get, in that instance, it's not considered to be a get me'useh. On the other hand, if it's a pressure or a fine, which basically locks the person into a position where there is no escape for them except by dealing with that issue or giving a get, that is considered to be a get mi'useh. And so what you have to do is you have to put pressures on the individual in such a manner where they can choose to accept those pressures. And it's possible for such an individual to live with those problems. He chooses to do or forego those issues and not give a get. Or he can make a decision to give the get and then get those rights or those penalties waived. On the other hand, if the pressure is such that there's no escape for this individual from that pressure, and then because of that pressure, the individual is going to give the get, that's considered to be a get me'useh. So in the modern day equivalent, if an individual is recalcitrant and doesn't give a get, if we, for that reason, we suspend their driver's license, or we take away their passport, so they're unable to travel. In all those cases, we're taking away privileges that the individual has, and now he can make a choice. He can forego those privileges and not give the get, or he can give the get and get those privileges back. On the other hand, if the guy is beaten into a pulp, and says rotzani because he's beaten into a pulp, In that instance, it may be a get milsa because he has no escape. He has no way to get out of that. They're going to keep beating him until he gives the get. So if they're going to keep beating him until he gets the get, then the get is a get milsa because the only reason he gave the get or agreed to it is because he was getting beaten and he wanted to escape from those beatings. It wasn't that he could live with the beatings and not give the get. That was an alternative. He only had one alternative. It's to say yes, because otherwise they're going to keep beating him and he wasn't sustainable. And so that would be the difference or the key element about whether get is considered to be a get mi'useh or not a get mi'useh. And so the Poskim and the Beit Yosef has a lot written about determining when it's considered to be something that is compelling versus where the person has a choice to escape from it. For instance, if they take away his right to live in the city, is there another place where he can go live? And so on and so forth. The major way that it's formulated today is the suspension of rights is allowed. And that could be the right to drive, the right to leave the country, the right to freedom. All of those rights can be suspended in order to compel the get, because the person can make a choice to live with that or to give the get. On the other hand, if it's, whether it's monetary pressure or physical pressure that is immediately placed on the individual, and therefore to escape that, they must give the get, that's considered to be a get mi'useh because they have no choice. They can't live with that monetary pressure or they can't live with the physical pressure. And that leads us into the sugya of the modern day cases where the bati dinim don't necessarily have the power to enforce this, but the secular courts do. And we saw in the Mishnah that as long as the secular courts are working under the auspices of the bati din, then that works. And so Rav Moshe Feinstein writes in Tshuvot about this issue. There was a question from someone in South Africa that was asking him that they were going to put into a law any individual who doesn't give a get will then be obligated to pay for the sustenance of the woman. And so there, Rav Moshe discusses the fact that the compelling of this individual to pay for the sustaining of his wife, the mizonot of his wife, is a halachic consideration. The man is already obligated to support his wife. If he's not going to free her, then he has to pay the mizonot. So when the courts are enforcing that, they're only enforcing something that he's already halakhically obligated in. And since he's halakhically obligated and they're telling him to fulfill his obligation, that's not considered to be a get mi'useh, or it's also not considered to be something where the courts are pressuring him with a non-halakhic matter. And so since that's a part of what he is halakhically obligated to do, and they're just compelling him to do what he's supposed to do, then in that case, that law would be a law that generates a get that is kasher and not mi'useh. And Rav Moshe writes there, v'nimtza, shema shechayvolo merakot, sach kesef bad mizonotah, the fact that the courts compel him to pay this money in order to support her, humamon shela, that is her money, as he explained above, even though technically she's not under his auspices anymore, he's not getting her masei yadayim, but because she cannot get married now because of him, she lacks the ability to be supported, and therefore he's obligated in her support. Sheinkan ones klau, that's not considered to be a compelled get. Shemegarsha kishetimcho lo achov, because when he divorces her, she'll waive that obligation. V'yatzaya dezem emasar, and that will allow him to be freed from his imprisonment. Afshi itchila begerushin, even though the whole thing revolves around gerushin, which is part of the problem. If the courts are acting not because of gerushin, but because of other considerations, it's fine. But if they're acting because they want to compel a get, that's when the problem arises. So what Rav Moshe says is that if he's obligated in the money anyway, then when they're acting, it doesn't matter that they mention the gerushin there because he has an outstanding obligation. What they can't do is create new obligations on the individual in order to then compel him to give the get, because then that is pressure that is derived simply from trying to draw a get from him. And it'll be problematic both from the perspective that now it's being enforced by a secular court and placed upon him in a secular court. And number two is then it becomes ones because they were specifically tied these penalties to the giving of the get. And according to some of the poskim, which we should discuss over here, that would make it into a problematic get because it's specifically premised on the get itself. But Moshe also has a second tshuva in which he says that if they put into effect a law or secular law that says that a person cannot get a civil divorce unless they give a get kasher, that also is fine, because again, if he wants to divorce her, which is a right or a privilege that he can, through the civil system, divorce this woman. So if he wants to get a civil divorce, then he must present a kosher divorce and a get. In that case, again, it's a fine institution or a fine halacha, because in order for them to grant the civil divorce, they want a halachic divorce to be in place. The halachic divorce will be determined by the Beit in Israel, whether that has been given or not been given. And based on that, the secular court is simply just enforcing what otherwise should be done by this individual based on the Batei Dinei Israel. And another tshuva that Rav Moshe brings is about prenuptials, in which there is an agreement in the prenuptial that both parties will subject themselves to whatever ruling Beit Din has. And the reason they put this into the prenuptials is because then it's enforceable in the secular court. And again, Rav Moshe says that's fine because, again, they're the secular courts. They're just going to enforce the obligations between the parties to arbitrate under a Beit Din. And that's exactly what we want. We want them to go to Beit Din in order to arbitrate the matter. Rav Moshe says you should just be careful that these types of prenuptials don't lead to fighting or quarreling beforehand or break up the shidduch or make it difficult, and just be careful beforehand. But he is on board and thinks that it's a good idea to establish these things up front, by which the secular courts can enforce something that is halachically in place and would halachically compel the husband to do what he's supposed to do or make an obligation on him. David Alevi writes in a tshuva about a law that was in place or going to be put in place in France by which the courts would be allowed to fine the individual if he doesn't give a get. And over there, the Shevet Alevi determines, even though there's a separation of church and state in France, nevertheless, the mere fact that the courts have the ability to impose the fine, and the fine is a derivative of the fact that he's not giving the get, that's already considered to be me'useh ayidei akum, and it's not a good get, because there all the obligation is deriving from a fine imposed by the secular courts. And that's exactly what's described in our Mishnah, that a get mi'useh b'din akum is not considered to be a good get, and it's definitely mi'useh, because the only reason he's giving the get is to get out of the fines. And therefore the fines are what are compelling him to give the get. In addition to that, the Shon Halacha, the Menashe Klein, writes about the get law that was put into New York, that he was very opposed to that law. He writes a ton of tshuvot about it. He actually went up to the Superior Court of New York and lobbied the justices over there to overturn the law based on the idea of separation of church and state. And he believes that the institution of the get law in New York is not only halakhically problematic, but is problematic within the legal system of New York State. And that is because it conflates issues of state and church. And because of that, it should be problematic not only under Jewish law, but also under the secular law. And so he petitioned them to annul that law because it was a violation of church and state. And then he explains his reasoning over there. From my little understanding, the get law in New York is written in such a way that the justice who is presiding over the proceedings of the divorce has the right to take into consideration the recalcitrance of the husband to give a get and is determining whether it's the split of the estate or the outcome of the alimony and custody battles between the two parties. And therefore, the get will weigh in that factor. So what Rav Menashe Klein argues is that the fact that that justice has a right to make decisions based on the get, that already means that he's imposing the secular law or using the secular law in order to compel a get. And it's not coming through Dinei Yisrael. It's not a determination whether the person is validly obligated to give a get or whether he should be compelled to give a get. And here he argues that many times that the secular judges are swayed by the plight of the woman or her sense of being a victim because the husband has to give a get. And therefore, they sometimes favor the woman, even though she is not justified or her position is wrong in the case, because they're not adjudicating this according to Dinei Yisrael. And he says, and it happens to be true, that there's been a huge shift in the other direction by which that the both communal pressures and the court pressures have actually, in many instances, given the woman the upper hand where she can demand a get and put the husband into such pressure to give the get, despite the fact that she may be wrong in that case, and she might not even be entitled to a get, and she's the problem in the case. He mentions it, but what has happened over time is that the tides have shifted in favor of the woman, and sometimes it actually works in the opposite direction, where the burden of proof is now sitting on the husband rather than the woman. And for that reason, he believes that the intervention of the courts into the issues of the get are basically having a get mi'useh ayidei a secular court, and the get is no good. And he writes that in many of his tshuvot. There are obviously others that argue that the get law in New York doesn't give them specific penalties, but again, it's just using what is otherwise the entitlement of the individual to a get and the settlement of all the claims surrounding the get, in order to get their rights or their privileges, they are then compelled to give a get. But not that there are penalties being imposed on the individual, simply decisions. He's been given the option to decide whether he likes this outcome or that outcome better. If he doesn't like the outcome, he might want to give the get to get a better outcome. If he's happy with the outcome, he may take that outcome, even though it's more detrimental to him, and he can live with it, but it'll be more detrimental. He might choose to do that because the court has decided that since he didn't want to give a get, he is not entitled to this, or he has less entitlement in the case. And therefore, they don't see that as being a get mi'useh. That's one topic, and that's, again, important to understand here, that when gitin are compelled, that they be done halakhically and properly, because in the end, if the get is not a good get, it ends up causing much more tsar and difficulty for the mother and her future family, because of the fact that people will cast aspersions on the get, there'll be questions about the get. And therefore, when we use a certain amount of, whether it's force or the secular courts, we have to be careful that it's done kedat v'din, so that it ends up that the get is a good get. And again, Rav Moshe Feinstein was very clear that he thought that we could use the secular courts to do this, as long as they were just enforcing what otherwise would have been the law and the batei dinim, or that the batei dinim themselves have paskin, and then that enforcement is only happening within the secular courts. In terms of erkaot shel goyim and the right or ability to go to secular courts, over here, the Midrashei Halacha and Chazal bring two reasons why an individual is not allowed to go to a secular court. One of them is mentioned in our daf, which is Ela Mishpatim Asher Tasim Lifneihem, Lifneihem Velo Fnei Akum, that you're allowed to present your dinim through the Jewish judges and not in front of the secular courts. And the Gemara says that even if they adjudicate the case in the same manner as the Jewish law, it doesn't matter. The fact that you go to a non-Jewish court in and of itself is problematic, irrespective of which laws or how they adjudicate the case. The second reason brought is the fact that it's yakar, which is that you're giving honor or reverence to the secular law or secular courts, especially when it's associated with a religious side to it, but even when it's not, over and above that of the batei dinim of Israel. And that is a declaration of values by which you are giving the secular courts or law more credence than that of halacha and the batei din. So that's the first thing as to why or what the problem is. And for that reason, as may the poskim note, the problem is not only a problem de rabbanan, this is a problem de oraita. This is a Torah law, and therefore someone who goes and into the court is in violation of an isur aseh that derives from elo mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem, is in violation of a din de oraita. That's number one. Number two is, as the poskim point out, it doesn't matter whether the people who are the judges in the court are Jewish or not Jewish, religious or not religious. It all has to do with the law by which they are adjudicating, and their samchut as being tamidei chachamim. And so therefore, even if you have courts in Israel which are governed by judges that are Jewish, or you have courts that adjudicate the case based on Jewish law, neither of those in of themselves make it into a court that is not considered to be Erkaot HaGoyim. And that's made clear by Ravadi Yosef, the Tzitz Eliezer, that secular courts within the side of Israel have a din of Erkaot Shel Goyim, and they're not considered to be Jewish courts. The Tzitz Eliezer writes very strongly against a lawyer who was claiming, with the fact that Hashem has granted us the right to come back to our land and establish our own law system, and that it's a reshit smichat gilutenu, and the fact that we can now go to the secular courts should be viewed as positive, because the batei dinim do not have the power to extract or enforce their judgments, and therefore she should have the right to go to the secular courts and not to a beitin, because it shouldn't be deemed as erkaot shel goyim. And the Tzitz Eliezer says he's absolutely wrong, and there's no such concept. The concept of erkaot shel goyim versus batei dinim revolves around, against tamidei chachamim and the halachic law, not the fact that they're Jewish judges or that it's in a Jewish state. None of that matters. The next thing we need to know is that, according to most of the Mifarshim, Dina de Machuta Dina does not apply in this instance. Dina de Machuta Dina applies in an instance where there's either a social contract or it's to the benefit of the government or the king to impose certain laws on the individuals. And we follow those laws because that is Dina de Machuta Dina. Where you live, you're subject to the laws of the land. But that does not mean or does not grant you the right to go to secular courts to adjudicate monetary matters because of Dina de Malchuta Dina. Now, you still are obligated to go to Beit Din and use the Jewish law and the Torah law in order to adjudicate the monetary matters. And so the fact that we paskin that Dina de Malchuta Dina, that does not change the fact that you still have to use Torah law and Bati Dinim to adjudicate these cases. And the way that in the Shuta Tashveis, he formulates it is, if you don't say that, then there won't be any Torah law left. Because then you always invoke Dina de Malchuta Dina, and then nobody will adjudicate based on the Torah law or the Bate Dinim. The other thing, the Rosh already notes this, that if they draw up a contract between them, and in the contract it says that we're allowed to adjudicate any altercations that come up in a Bate Din or in a secular court, the Rosh says that that T'nai is Batel, because one is not allowed to create such a condition, and they're obligated to go to the Beit Din and not go to the secular court in that instance. And even if they accept the secular court as arbitrators, which in a sense any two parties are allowed to do is to accept arbitration, because then they can even use a Roet Zon, as the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, nevertheless, the Rosh and many others believe that that is a violation. It's a violation of Din Doraita because you're using their laws instead of using the Batei Din. The only question that really comes up in the post-scheme there is if they do arbitrate in that manner, whether it is binding. And there the Rishonim argue about whether Bidiavad, if you did it, it's binding on the parties and they have to abide by that arbitration, meaning going to the secular court. Or even that din of the secular courts is unwound because the arbitration was done incorrectly. And since it was improper for them to go there, therefore it's not binding on either party. But as far as going to the courts, nobody thinks that that is a valid condition of the contract or a valid method for adjudicating the problem. The next thing to note is that the poskim say over here that if a person improperly goes to a secular court, then a lawyer, a religious lawyer who is representing that individual should not be representing them in a case where they're going to the secular court improperly. And actually, they'll become Elifnei Iver, Lo Titen Mechshol, Umesayel Ovrei Avera. The only time they have permission is if they are a defense lawyer, meaning that if the other party is now being compelled to go to the secular court because of the mistake or the initiation of another party, and now they have to go to the secular court to defend themselves, then the religious Orach Din, the lawyer, can defend that party because it's the equivalent of saving them from a me'anes, from someone who's going to take away their money. They can't just forfeit or cede the case because they have to go to secular court. Of course, they can defend themselves. And in defending themselves, they're allowed to bring in a lawyer to help them defend themselves. So that's all in the way of background. Then there is a progression, which seemingly through the Tshuvot. Back in the time of the Gaonim already, the Gaonim are dealing with this issue. And they say that everybody is obligated to go to the Batei Din Yisrael. But if it's an individual who does not listen to the Batei Din Yisrael and will not follow the instructions of the Beit Din Yisrael, you have a right then to take them to the secular court and compel them to make the payment. Because they call it over there, it's the equivalent of Ashavat Aveda or Matzil Mimono. He's saving his money, meaning that you can use these means to save your money from being taken from you incorrectly or improperly. And that's whether it's with a non-Jew or with a Jew, you're allowed to again get your money because this other party is unwilling to submit to the ruling of the Beit Din. But one cannot initiate or start in the secular courts. One must start in the Jewish courts. But if the Jewish courts have no jurisdiction or ability to deal with this individual, then in that case, they can go to the non-Jewish courts. In the Tshuvot of the Gaonim, it's not clear that when it's obvious or it's clear that this individual will not subject themselves to the Batei Din Yisrael, whether you can go straight to the Akum. But it develops more clearly in the Rishonim, where the Rishonim say that you always have to go to the Beit Din first. And then once you have a psak of the Beit Din and you want to get that enforced, then you can use the secular courts to enforce the psak din of the Beit Din. And only then is it considered not to be erka uta goyim, because you're just using the secular court as a vehicle to get to the psak of the Beit Din. Because if the psak of the Beit Din cannot be enforced, then the only way to get it or to save your money is to go to the secular courts. And that's really the tension throughout history with the Batei Dinim, is that the more autonomy that the Batei Dinim are given, then the easier the situation is. Because if they have the rights to adjudicate, or they have the right to enforce, like it was in Bavel, then it sits as an autonomous entity, and they can enforce and they can adjudicate, and it has almost the full force of the law behind it. And because of that, the Bate Dinim, people will go there, and the cases will be adjudicated, and they'll compel the results to be enforced. On the other hand, in places where the Bate Dinim are independent and do not have the enforceability or the samchut of the laws of the land, then that's where the tension arises, which is that individuals who go to the Bate Din might get the right answer, but they can't get an enforcement of that answer. And that's what leads many people to not go to the Bate Dinim and to go to the secular courts, as well as other issues where are written up by the Poskim over here, where they know they're going to lose in the Dine Yisrael, but they know under the law of the land that they can win, so therefore they'll go to the secular courts instead of the Bate Dinim. But in all those cases, the Rishonim write very strongly against such practices and say that the person must go to the Beit Din first and get the case adjudicated, and get the case decided. And once the case is decided, or the individual is misarev, refuses to come to the Beit Din, and over there the Gaonim call him a Love Alim, which is a borrower of money who has strong political position or power, and therefore he doesn't pay back the money, then you can go to the secular courts in order to get it back. On the other hand, when the Ramban is writing in his tshuva, he says, I don't know who these Gaonim are, and I don't know what tshuva they're talking about. And the Ramban, again, narrows the scope of your ability to go to the secular courts, demanding that you first go to the Bate Dinim in order to get the case adjudicated, and only afterwards, if it's Matzil Mamono, then you can go to the secular courts. But not just to go after these strong men who won't subject themselves to the enforcement of Beit Din, even before the case is adjudicated by the Beit Din. There's an interesting case that came up in Israel, in the Bate Din in Yerushalayim, about an individual who comes to the Beit Din, and wants to know if it's okay to go to the secular courts because he was slandered in the newspapers. And the only way to get enforcement to have them reverse the slander and pay for the damage that was done to the individual is to go through the secular courts and not through the Beit Din. Court in Yerushalayim, the Beit Din Yerushalayim says, Mutar lemavakesh lifnot beit hamishpat b'tviya plilit keneged ha'iton. That you can go to the secular courts in that case because of what it writes here. B'makom shena gazlan choshesh l'dinei Yisrael. When you have a thief that doesn't care about the Dine Yisrael, you can go to the secular courts to get it enforced. And they quote the Tashbetz, who quotes this tshuva from the Geonim, to allow individuals to go to the secular courts in an instance where that's the only means of enforcement or the only set of laws that this individual will listen to. And even though, as they write there, the practice has become that they go to the Beit Din first, then the Beit Din subpoenas the individual three times, and they put a cherem on the individual. But in a case where it's muhsaklan, we are clear that the nidva, it does not care about this stuff, and it's going to make no difference and have no impact. The Beit Din here was willing to waive all of that and allow the person to go directly to the secular courts in order to adjudicate this case. And Rav Nasha Klein in the Mishnah Halachot also discusses the issue of whether one can be a juror in a secular court. And he thinks that it's problematic and is subject to the Ela Mishpatim Asher Tasim Lifneihem, and that it's improper, even in cases of monetary matters, to be a juror in those cases, because the laws do not follow the Torah laws, and they let in things like circumstantial evidence and other items that are not allowed under the Jewish law. With that, we'll stop at the Mishnah at the bottom of Pechet Amud Beth.